Okay, I want to say hi, doggies. They're so cute. Wait, there they are again. Hello, look at that face. Oh, how nice. So, hi, everybody, and welcome to Enlightened Leadership. Don, I need to know if my sound is at least as good as usual or if it's bad. Okay, because I'm actually uploading the video that's been uploading for an hour. I didn't know if that would affect this or not, but it looks like I'm okay. Good. Otherwise, I would have switched to my phone. All right. So I'm not playing music anymore because Don said that my music, you know, kind of drags. And she said I could send her the songs in advance. I'm like, we'll just skip the music. So I'm going to be jumping right into the teaching this time. I hope you didn't come just for the song. So we're going to verse 34 in the Tao Te Ching. And we're going to start with Derek Lynn. And this is a small verse, so I will read it in all four and then pick whichever ones I want to focus on after I read it. So here we go. The softest things of the world override the hardest things of the world. That which has no substance enters into that which has no openings. I like that. That's very cool. From this, I know the benefits of unattached actions, the teaching without words. The benefits of actions without attachment are rarely matched in the world. Dr. Wayne Dyer. The softest of all things overrides the hardest of all things. That without substance enters where there is no space. Hence, I know the value of non-action. Teaching without words, performing without actions, few in the world can grasp it. That is the master's way. Rare indeed are those who obtain the bounty of this world. Stephen Mitchell. The gentlest thing in the world overcomes the hardest thing in the world. That which has no substance enters where there is no space. This shows the value of non-action. Teaching without words, performing without actions, that is the master's way. And last but not least, Victor Mayer. The softest thing under heaven gallops triumphantly over the hardest thing under heaven. Non-being penetrates non-space. Hence, I know the advantages of non-action. The doctrine without words, the advantage of non-action. Few under heaven can realize these. So they were all about the same. I think I'm going to look at Wayne Dyer. We don't really have a lot of differences, and his was a little poetic. I kind of liked it, so we'll look at him. So again, starting with the beginning of the 43rd verse, the softest of all things overrides the hardest of all things. And in fact, I happened to read two sentences out of Wayne Dyer's book when I opened it a while ago. I just kind of glanced down, and I'm going to read those two sentences to you now. He says, in this verse, Lao Tzu invites you to change the way you view hardness. To you, the concept is probably equated with strength. And I think that as a general rule in the world, that's probably true. Somebody, I can't remember who it was, maybe Jacqueline, maybe somebody else, I don't remember who it was, it was a few years ago, might have even been Danielle, it's irrelevant, found a picture of me on the internet from back before the spiritual path, when I was the director of training at private healthcare systems in Waltham. I had spoken at some conference. Yep, I was doing that kind of stuff then too. And this was a picture of me up on the stage. I don't remember if I was speaking alone or if it was part of a panel, but it was a picture of me on the stage. And what the person commented on was, look how hard your face looked then. And I looked and went, oh my God, like you can visibly see the difference, you know, from that businesswoman, Regina, that I was then. And then whatever this is that I am now, a visible difference. And I've had a number of people tell me that when they see me, they think I look younger than the time before, which of course is not the case. You know, it's getting older, right? But where does this come from? And I think it comes from the softening. You know, people in this world tend to feel that you've got to be hard and you got to make things happen. You know, right now, Jasmine is in that position where she's applying for jobs because she's in her last year of university. And Ron is always telling her, you know, like if they didn't get back to you in 2 days, you know, you need to email them and, you know, you got to be aggressive. And the one who goes after the worm is the one who gets it. And, you know, Jasmine's a little more laid back than that. She doesn't always follow his advice. Sometimes she feels to do the emails and sometimes she doesn't. I'm happy that she's trusting her intuition about that. But what I notice is his, you know, you got to get out there. You got to get what you want attitude. Where my feeling is very genuinely that whatever's supposed to unfold for her will. You know, and of course there'll be some steps she has to take, you know, but she'll know those steps. And there can be a naturalness and an ease. And when she gets fearful, which she does, in fact, she got fearful earlier this week. And I don't remember exactly what I told her, but it was, she was trying to think, well, what if this happens? And then I'll have to do this. And then this will happen. And then I'll have to do this. And this will happen. And she was at like five or six steps ahead where she is right now. And I said something like the best way to go through this is just to take the next step. And when you take the next step, then the step after that will reveal itself. You know, so I'm always trying to help her to be ease, softness, trusting, allowing, watching. See, those things are all soft. It's not that I don't want her to get a job. I think a job is absolutely the next step for her. And if somehow she was avoiding getting a job, I probably would be talking to her about that because that would be an avoidance for her, right? It's just that I believe what this verse is saying. The softest of all things overrides the hardest of all things. You know, that without substance enters where there is no space. You know, the universe is going to lay out the perfect path for her if she just leans back, opens up, and follows what the universe provides. You know, it's just that simple. In fact, I don't actually think we ever genuinely make a path open up for us. That may be our perception if we were pushing our way through the world. But I think what was happening is there was already this crack that was going to open up as we moved in that direction, right? But because we didn't see the crack, I wish I had, I'm going to use two books to do this because I want to do this and show you exactly. So imagine this is the little crack, right? This is the little crack that's going to open up for me as I go in that direction. But because I'm not wise enough to realize that, I'm bumping my head, you know? And then when it opens up, I think I did it. I think it was my head bumping that opened it up. But that's not true. And I don't know if you guys have ever paid any attention, but there's a big difference in your experience between feeling hard and feeling open and soft. Every now and then I'll feel that hardness come on me for a moment or two. And I let go of it as soon as possible. When you become unaccustomed to living with the hardness is unbearable. The softness is so sweet. The softness is so pleasant. You know, the softness is what they call inner peace. That's one of the words they put on it. So the softest of all things overrides the hardest of all things. You know, I'm also remembering, I'm remembering two things at once. One is Jesus, one is Peace Pilgrim. And remember, Jesus said in his Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are the meek, right? That's the soft, not the hard. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. That's really the exact same teaching as the softest of all things overrides the hardest of all things. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Same teaching. But the other thing I'm reminded of is, again, some stories from Peace Pilgrim, you know, the way she was. And for those of you who don't know, she really was my first genuine inspiration on the spiritual path. You know, like one story she has is about a time when she was watching a little girl. I don't remember how old the girl was. And while she was watching this girl, Peace was sitting inside, I think writing a letter by the window, and the girl was outside playing. And what happened was a man pulled up. I don't know who he was. I don't know if he was a father, a stepfather, a boyfriend. You know, notice how I assume he was a member of the family. Could have been a stranger, but I doubt it. Because, right, who do women have to fear the most in this world? Right, they're the males in their own family, unfortunately. So it probably was something like that. So anyway, this girl's outside playing, and this man pulls up, and he starts coming after this girl in a very aggressive manner. And it looked as if he was going to hurt her. And so Peace, you know, went out there, I envision pretty quickly, although she doesn't say that. But, you know, even the soft can walk fast when necessary. And she got between the man and the little girl. And she just looked at the man with compassion. She didn't say a word. She just looked at him. And he softened and left. The softest of all things overrides the hardest of all things. There's another story about when she was walking, and at this time in her life, she didn't accept rides at all. Later in her life, she did. But at this point, she didn't. And she was walking, and a man pulled up and offered her a ride. I think it was at night. And a man pulled up and offered her a ride, and she said that she didn't accept rides. And he said, well, that was all right. You know, she needed to rest, and he would just park. He wouldn't go anywhere. She could come into his car and take a nap. And so she did. He pulled over. She got in his car, and she pulled over, and she took a nap. And when she woke up, this man was just sitting there staring at her in this curious way, which led her to ask, you know, what was going on with him. And he told her that when he picked her up, he did not have good intentions. It sounds like his intentions were probably to rape her. But he says when she curled up and went to sleep so trustingly, he couldn't touch her. The softest of all things overrides the hardest of all things. And there's another story. There was some young man, I gather he was around 16 or 17, but I don't know for sure. And if I did know for sure, I've forgotten. But he had a history of being violent. And in fact, if I recall correctly, he had even beat his own mother. And his mother asked for assistance from Peace Pilgrim. And so what Peace did was she took this young man hiking. She must have been a lot like me, huh? That's what I would do with you too. I'd take you hiking. She took this young man hiking. And I guess they got up on top of a mountain somewhere or a hill. You know, I doubt they were in the Rockies, but they might have been. She went everywhere. They got up on top of a mountain somewhere, and a thunderstorm came. When the thunderstorm came and the lightning started, the young man got very, very afraid. And for some reason, he did what his conditioning guides him to do. He turned and turned on peace and he started beating on her. And she just remained soft without compassion. She did not defend herself in any way. And at some point, he stopped. He just stopped. I don't know if he broke down and cried or not, but that's in my image of the story. Might not be in the book, I don't know. But what is in the book is that he never beat anyone again. The softest of all things overrides the hardest of all things. And you know, I don't think we can be the softest of all things with an intention for a particular change. You know, Jesus talks about this in a Course in Miracles. I think at the very beginning of in the miracle principles, he says that miracles have to be under Christ. I can't remember the exact words. You know, I want to say under the Christ consciousness rule, under Christ's rule, right? I don't remember the exact words. I don't know if somebody else does. But it's not up to us to choose the miracle. It's not up to me to say for Christ control. Thank you, Don. The miracles have to be under Christ's control. And he says that if we try and determine what the miracle should be, he says that could be severely misguided. I always remember those words exactly. Severely misguided. Well, in our own way, what we're trying to do, if we're trying to use softness to create a particular outcome, is that we're trying to manipulate the universe, which means it's actually hardness in disguise. Softness doesn't try to manipulate. So if I have decided, for example, that I'm going to be really soft, and through my softness, this person's going to change in such and such a way, I'm not genuinely being soft, I'm being hard. It's just I chose a mask of softness. But softness is having no attachment to outcome. Softness is allowing everything to be as it is. Softness is the loving all method. Softness is being just for the sake of being. If there's any selfish reason at all that's valid in softness, the only selfishness that's valid in softness is how it makes me feel. I'm soft because I feel at peace, right? That one, I think that's okay. That's not a hardness. I once heard the term divine selfishness. You know, it's kind of the right use of selfishness, right? I'm soft because then I'm at peace. There can be no other reason. Any other reason is manipulation and therefore it's hardness. But who knows if you choose softness for no other reason other than that's what feels best to me. Who knows what miracles may come out of that? Because the softest of all things overrides the hardest of all things. That without substance enters where there is no space. You know, if we think of the story of Peace Pilgrim and the man who wanted to rape her, or the man who was going to do some kind of harm to that little girl, you know, in our world, you know, if we just allow ourselves some judgmental thought for a second, these guys are the hardest of all things. You know, here's a guy that wants to rape an old woman. Here's a guy who wants to beat a little girl. Right, that's hard. That's just very hard. You know, there's typically no space in that type of mindset. And yet peace's softness was able to overcome in both of these circumstances. That without substance enters where there is no space. If I have any kind of an intention at all, I am not that without substance. I have this intention, therefore I have substance. If I have, I'm going to use a book again. If there is no space, this book is closed, there's no space there, and I have substance, I can't force my way in. Only that without substance can allow the opening, can find the opening to get its way in, right? Hey, baby. There's a cute wagging tail behind George. I love wagging tails. Hi. I love doggies more than anything. So there we go. All right. So only that without substance could get in here, right? And find the opening. And again, that can't come from my intention. I have to be intentionless. That without substance enters where there is no space. Hence, I know the value of non-action. What is non-action? You know, I think some people who aren't very far on the spiritual path sometimes interpret non-action as doing nothing. But non-action is not necessarily doing nothing. I mean, it might be. Non-action is having no intention to do anything. Non-action is just being happy, being at peace, okay with how things are. And then again, if some kind of doing occurs, that doing is coming from the Tao, not from a me with an idea about what should have been done. So the non-action isn't really a word about form, whether, you know, something gets done or not. The non-action is a word about how empty and intentionless I am. And the reason non-action works is because it is that without substance. And that without substance enters where there is no space. The softest of all things overrides the hardest of all things. That without substance enters where there is no space. Hence, I know the value of non-action. Teaching without words. It may not look like that right now, but that's what I'm doing. Teaching with words would be if I had spent this morning reading over these books, reading over their interpretations, making notes on what I thought was right, what I thought was wrong, and coming in here in the language of the world fully prepared and shared a teaching from that. That's teaching with words. You know, all I do, and you guys, I know you know this, all I do before a teaching is look and see what verse I'm teaching this week. And I go in and I make sure all the books are dog-eared on the right page, so I hopefully open it up to the right page. That's the extent of my preparation. I don't even read the verse. Today, my eyes happened to land on two sentences, and I told you that, and I read those two sentences to you, but I hadn't even read the verse through. There is really no preparation here. So the words that I speak are words that are coming as I'm speaking. There's no preparation here. There's no intention here. I'm not trying to say what I think you need to hear. Right? So this is teaching without words. It's just like acting without intention. It's just being empty, and then the Tao comes through. You know, the Tao reminds me of what Jesus said in the Bible. The Tao reminds me of those stories about Peace Pilgrim. And whatever else I said. See, I can't even remember what else I've said. And the reason I can't remember what else I've said is because it wasn't prepared. It wasn't planned. It wasn't implanted in the brain. It's just moving through. I mentioned to you guys when Meg was teaching on Sunday that I had received an email from someone who was criticizing what I said last Wednesday night. during a Nisargadatta teaching, and he was saying, "You said this, and you know it's wrong, and here's why." And you said this. I'm like, "Wow, did I say those? I don't remember if I said those things or not." So I had to go back and listen. I had no idea what I'd said. I had said one of those things. All of the other things were misheard. The words that he said were not the words I said. But I didn't defend myself at all with him. I wrote to him and said something like, "Thank you so very much for caring enough to write to me when you think I'm, you know, going in the wrong way," you know, something like that. But I did go back because, you know, Byron Katie says that, you know, when you're criticized, you need to look and see if there's any truth to that criticism. And since I couldn't remember what I said, I didn't know if the teaching was right or wrong. I didn't know if I was off or not. I couldn't even remember what I said. So I went back and I listened. I thought, I don't hear anything wrong with that. So that's okay. And then Meg does this beautiful teaching where she comments on it. I go, okay, well, there's double confirmation that I'll just forget about this. It's fine. But you know, the reason I didn't have any idea what I'd said is because there was no planning in what I said. It just came. Sometimes I love it. Sometimes when I hear people teaching here in the sanctuary, they're really doing a wonderful job. I can just hear the inspiration coming through, and then they'll say, do you know what they'll say? They'll say, "Oh, I'm just babbling here." And I want to scream, "No, don't go there. You're not babbling. That's inspiration coming through you right now. You have no idea what you're saying. It's bypassing the brain. That's why you think you're babbling, right? But you're not babbling. You're being empty right now. The talking is happening. Your mind is not doing it. That's perfection. So babble away, right? Babble away. Teaching without words. And of course, performing without actions. Again, we've already talked about that. That's having intention. I want to get this done. No attachments, right? And then he says, few in the world can grasp it. I think that's true. I think that most people cannot imagine. Well, I mean, when you go to speech class in high school or college and they teach you how to speak in front of people, you know, you can take a whole semester on how to prepare and practice so that you speak well. I mean, it's the exact opposite of what I ask you guys to do. I say, show up, you know, go ahead and have a topic. Maybe you have a book or a reading that you're going to read. And then, you know, as you read, you kind of bounce off of it like I do. But don't do anything else. Just show up. You know, and that's the same guidance that Jesus gave to the apostles when he set them out two by two to teach. Right? He told them not to take anything with them, not to take money with them, to in no way be prepared. You know, and if they were welcome there, but then, you know, share there. And if they weren't welcome there, to leave, and he said, and to wipe the dust off their feet. And some people read that in a very judgmental way, like, oh, those people wouldn't listen to me. I'm going to wipe that dust off my feet. But the way I read it is, don't get stuck on that. Don't get stuck that you aren't welcome there. Just move on. You know, find where the flow is taking you. Don't try and get hard. Don't try and get hard and force your teaching on those who aren't interested in hearing it. Just gently wipe the dust off your feet and move on. George, I just love that. I wish he was licking. Is he licking your ear? I wish he was licking my ear. Yeah. So no preparation other than, like I said, some reasonable preparation, dog-earing the page, knowing what I'm going to read from, you know. But then just let it happen. Teaching with no words, performing without actions, few in the world can grasp it. That is the master's way. And, you know, I can see maybe some of you sometimes saying to me, yeah, but I'm not a master. I need to prepare. My response, although I'm usually much nicer in person, I can be a little ruder when I'm teaching because it's not personal, right? So I might not say this in person because I wouldn't want you to be offended, but I can say it now. How do you expect to become a master if you're going to prepare? That's what I really think. How do you expect to become a master if you keep leaning on those crutches? The only way to find out that the inspiration is going to come through you without your preparation is to show up without preparing. I've listened to some of my original teachings, you know, back like in 2005 and 2006, and I used to read a lot more then. You know, I would read like a paragraph, maybe two paragraphs, and then something would come to my mind to say, and I would speak. And then I would read a paragraph or two or three, then something would come to my mind to speak. Now I barely get through a sentence, you know, a phrase. Oh, I got to stop right here. Here comes something. It's kind of like the pump got primed, you know, by me being willing to show up unprepared. I've always been unprepared. I have never prepared for a teaching in my life. I do these outlines for retreats, but if you see them, you'll see how skeletal they are. I've never prepared for a teaching. But somehow by being willing to show up unprepared, even though in the beginning I was doing a lot more reading, comments did come. And I trusted those comments and I made them. And what happened over time was the inspiration became so strong that a whole lot less reading happens now. I'll read a line or a part of a line and I'm filled with the inspiration. I just go with it. And then when it stops, I go back and I read the next line. You know, and I do hear people occasionally say things like, well, you know, Regina can do it, but I can't. But Regina couldn't either when she started. That's the point. See, that's the point. The point is you show up, you do it to the best of your current ability, and guess what? Your current ability increases. But if you never, ever let go of the crutch of preparation, you're never going to learn about the inspiration that could come through you without your brain. We have a couple ministers here in town who find inspiration all week long. It's beautiful watching them do it. They find inspiration all week long and they get so excited and they jot it down. And that inspiration seems genuine. I've seen them do it. It seems genuine. But then they take that inspiration and they write a sermon and they stand in front of their congregations, I'm told, and read from their iPad. It would be nice if they just jotted down the inspirations like a skeletal outline, because they came in a very genuine way. And then stood up, glanced at the first inspiration, maybe even told the story of how that inspiration came this week. And after that, they'd be off and running. They might not even make it through all of their inspirations, because so much more inspiration would come in that moment through them that they haven't pre-considered. Teaching without words, performing without actions, few in the world can grasp it. That is the master's way. Rare indeed are those who obtain the bounty of this world. What is the bounty of this world? That's the best thing this world has to offer. And that's awakening. You know, A Course in Miracles says... A Course in Miracles says that the Holy Spirit's interpretation of this world, you know, to the Holy Spirit, the only thing this world is for is healing. So the highest thing this world has to offer is awakening. Awakening from the world, eventually. But rare indeed are those who obtain the bounty of this world. So that means you obtain that bounty by being soft instead of hard, by being empty instead of having intentions, by allowing the teaching to unfold instead of preparing. That's how you obtain the bounty. And that is the 43rd verse. And I'm going to go right on to the 44th, because guess what? No more words are coming, nor do I feel any inclination to pick up another book. So I'm going to trust that. I'm going to trust the move on feeling as much as I trust the stay feeling, right? So 44. Fame or the self, which is dearer? The self or wealth, which is greater? Gain or loss, which is more painful? Thus, excessive love must lead to great spending. Excessive hoarding must lead to heavy loss. Knowing contentment avoids disgrace. Knowing when to stop avoids danger. I heard a joke on that one. I'll tell you the joke in a second. Knowing when to stop avoids danger. Thus, one can endure indefinitely. So the joke that I heard when I read knowing when to stop avoids danger, imagine for a moment if I had had this thought, ooh, I usually only do one verse in an hour. I still have 20 minutes. I should find something else to say about verse 43. I shouldn't move on. Then I would have got into the head. Do you see how that's thinking? I would have got into the head and would have got myself into danger. Knowing when to stop avoids danger. I'm going to at least look at one more, and I'm going to look at Victor Mayer, because that's what I feel to do. Oh, and he says it completely differently, so it's kind of cool looking at both of these side by side. Victor says, name or person, which is nearer? Person or property, which is dearer? Gain or loss, which is drearier? Many Christina? Loves. Yes?
Cheryl wants to ask you a question.
Oh, sorry. What's the question?
It's actually not a question, Regina. It's so interesting what you were just saying. I opened up 44th verse in this book that I have, Wayne Dyer's. I mean, I'm just blown away. Here's what it says on the left-hand side. I let go of my need for more and live in a state of pure gratitude. Giving is replacing my demand for more. And that's exactly what you just demonstrated. So thank you.
I love that sentence. Giving away is replacing my demand for more. Getting. That's beautiful.
Beautiful. Thank you.
All right. So let me go back to the top then. Name or person, which is nearer? Person or property, which is dearer? Gain or loss, which is drearier? This almost rhymes, which is unusual in the Tao, especially since it wasn't written in English, right? Many loves entail great loss. Many riches entail heavy losses. Oh, sorry. Many loves entail great costs. Many riches entail heavy losses. No contentment, and you shall not be disgraced. No satisfaction, and you shall not be imperiled. Then you will long endure. So let's just look at these two since we're limited on time. I don't have a whole hour now. So Derek Lynn said, fame or self, which is dear. And I took the self to be not the true self, but the practice, the care that takes one to the true self, right? Paying attention to this self in the way that you do when you're doing spiritual practice, right? There's a way you pay attention to what this self is thinking, whether this self has an attachment or not, right? So which is more important to you, paying attention to this self in that way or being famous? I remember there's a spiritual teacher out there, A Course in Miracles teacher. You know, I got to know a few of these teachers on a somewhat personal basis when I used to do all those conferences and stuff. And gradually, one by one, I became disillusioned. And this was my disillusion the moment with one teacher. One teacher told me that his or her highest goal was, I'm beating the drum here, not awakening. It's not what came out of the mouth. It was to be on Oprah. Immediately disillusioned. I haven't listened to that teacher since. Right? Because if that's the goal that's driving that teacher, well, that teacher's not acting from inspiration. That teacher's acting from, you know, what can I say? What can I teach? What books can I write? What can I do that's going to get me the attention I need that's finally going to land me on Oprah? So, what's dear? I mean, there's nothing wrong with being on Oprah. Oprah has interviewed some wonderful teachers, Michael Singer among them, David Hawkins, right? There's nothing wrong with being on Oprah, but do you love the truth enough that if you were invited to be on Oprah and the prompt was no, that you'd say no to Oprah? Right? Do you love the truth enough that you would say no to Oprah if prompted, if that was the honest intuition? Or is Oprah your highest goal? You know, what's most important to you? Same thing with publishing books, you know. Are you willing to sell yourself out, and do whatever some big famous publisher asks you to do in order to get that big famous publisher when really that's not the inner guidance. That's just the way of the world. Are you willing to not be famous, to not be noticed for truth? You know, this is where you find out where your heart is. But the way that the way Victor Mayer says that is a little different. He says name or person, which is nearer. And the answer to the question, as far as I understand, is person. And it's kind of funny because most of my teachings teach, you know, that the person is actually out there, right? Awareness is closer. But name or person, which is nearer. The name is the outer reputation. That's what the outer people call you. That's how the outer people see you. The person is intimate. This is who you go to bed with, who you wake up with, right? So which are you going to be true to? The name? Do you care more about how people see you, what people think of you? Or do you care more about your own inner integrity? Now, a lot of people may not care about fame, and primarily because they don't think they have a shot in heck of ever getting famous, so why care about it? But the way that Victor words it, this is something that everybody, I think, might get mired up in. Just how others see me. Which is more important to you, how others see you or your integrity? You know, are you willing to walk away from awakening together if called to do so? Or are you worried what people would say if you left? You know, it's hard for me to think of many examples here for some reason. The fame thing was a little easier, but I think that we all know that there are times where we do not behave according to our total integrity because we're concerned about what others think about us. And so the question is, what's more important, your name or your person? Right? Your most intimate relationship with yourself, your relationship with them, or your most intimate relationship with yourself. Next, they say, the self or wealth, which is greater? I don't think I even have to talk about that. I think we all get that question. You know, are we more interested in our spiritual practice and following our guidance or making that money? And he words it, person or property, which is greater. I think that's the same question. I mean, if I turn down Oprah, I'm probably not just turning down Oprah. I'm turning down getting a better publisher. I'm turning down getting lots of book sales. I'm turning down lots and lots and lots of people hearing about me, right? So maybe I don't really care about Oprah, but all that other stuff. I mean, think of the money I'd make if I was on Oprah, right? So what's more important, my own integrity with myself, which to me is following my own guidance, my own intuition, or that fame, that money, that, you know, what the world offers as treasure? And then they say gain or loss, which is more painful. And they both basically say that, gain or loss, which is drearier. You know, most people think that loss is drearier, right? Loss is more painful. But I think what Lao Tzu is trying to tell us is actually if you gain in the world, you lose spiritually. But that's not hardcore true. I mean, there are people like Eckhart Tolle and Byron Katie who I think are fairly wealthy. You know, you could say they've gained in the world, but I don't think they have any attachment to it. I think it's irrelevant. And if it all disappeared tomorrow, Michael Singer is another one, right? He at least was, I don't know if he still is, a billionaire with a B. You know, so this isn't hardcore, oh my God, if you make money, you're going to lose spiritually. Again, this is more about your inner attachment, what's important to you. If these outer things are more important to you, then you lose by gaining. And in fact, that's one of Michael Singer's stories, although I confess I haven't read the book, and I'll tell you why in a moment. I read part of the book, but I haven't read all of it. But enough people have told me what's in it that I think I know. I think I'm not wrong, but I could be. Right? He was sued. He was facing losing everything. And from what I understand, he chose to stick to his integrity. He didn't get all hard and, you know, do all the things that you do to fight a lawsuit. Right? He chose to stick to his integrity. And I don't even know what happened. I don't know if he won or lost the lawsuit because, you know what, I don't really even care. What matters to me is that he stuck to his integrity. And I'll tell you why I never finished reading the book. The book is The Surrender Experiment, right? And he was kind of like that movie, The Yes Man. He just said yes to whatever showed up. So I was reading the book and really enjoying it. I really liked the book. And I was about halfway through this book. And I think I might've just got to the part where he was getting sued, but I didn't really get to read that story. And somebody said to me, oh, I'm going to take your book home. And my first thought was, what? And then I remembered, yes. And I gave them my book. Now I will tell you that somebody sent me that book. Somebody heard that story and sent me a book earlier this year, so I will eventually turn around and finish reading it. It's back on my bookshelf again. It came in the mail, which I thought was really sweet that somebody heard the story and sent me the book. But you know, really, what in me would have said, no, I'm reading this book. I like it. I'll give it to you when I'm done. I mean, even that. I mean, that may sound very practical, right? But even that. Am I willing to lose everything, even a book I'm reading? Am I willing to just let the universe give what the universe gives and let the universe take away what the universe takes away while I stay the fool on the hill, right? The still happy one. That's really what this is about. It's not about whether you have or don't have. My God, I have a lot. I mean, you know, way more than I ever imagined. You know, I have, in a way, two houses. That's not counting, you know, other little places like the retreat house or Jasmine's apartment or Ron's apartment. I have two houses, and we're looking into building another, you know, a big old custom. Well, it's not big. It's big for me. A big old fancy custom house. You know what I mean? But that stuff's not important to me. It was. It's not now. Just keeps coming, probably because I dreamed about it for so long and I can't make it stop. But what's important? That's the question. What's important to you? You know, what if your house burns down? Are you okay? Shauna can answer that question. Her house burnt down. You know, are you okay? No contentment and you shall not be disgraced. Just be happy all the time. That's the moral of the story. Whether things appear to be coming in this phase or whether things appear to be going in this phase, don't let that phase you. Just be happy. No contentment and you shall not be disgraced. Let me see what the other one says. Knowing contentment avoids disgrace. Same thing. No satisfaction, you shall not be imperiled. Okay, let me look up imperiled. I'll tell you what, I know this isn't what, I don't think this is what imperiled mean, but I'll tell you what occurred to me was impelled at the same time. Yeah, well, impelled could be one cause of being in peril. Right? In peril is put at risk of being harmed, injured, or destroyed. So be careful. You may be impelled. So knowing no satisfaction and you shall not be imperiled. You're not in danger of the loss. I mean, the words of Kenny are the loss of your soul. But I don't mean soul the way soul is usually defined. I mean your core purpose that is leading all the way to your awakening. That's what I mean by soul in this moment. No satisfaction and you shall not lose your soul. Your soul is not in danger, right? If you are happy, you are walking the path to awakening. Happiness is the path. This is what chapter 15 in Michael Singer's book is all about. You know, a lot of people want to wait till they get there to be happy. No, no, no. Happiness is the way. Just start being happy now. Make a commitment to happiness now. And the way chapter 15 words it in The Untethered Soul is it has to be unconditional happiness. Like happy if the money is coming in, happy if the money is going out. Happy if people appear to like you, happy if people appear to become disillusioned, no longer trust you, and walk away. Yeah, that was the decision I made about the retreat house just a few days before we found it. There was somebody around me who thought that I was somehow quitting on the retreat house because I wasn't doing things the way she thought that I should. I tried to explain to her that I wasn't quitting. In fact, I told her I felt like Necron, you know, with the Red Sea up to my neck right here, up here probably at that point. You know, I felt like I was walking the Red Sea and the waters up to here. I didn't feel like I was quitting. I said, but, you know, I have to accept that at my next step I might drown or I won't keep walking. You know, I have to accept that one of the possibilities here is that we don't get a retreat house and that everybody says, oh my God, Regina's guidance was so fake and everybody loses respect for me and awakening together falls and nobody ever pays attention to me again. So I have to accept that as a possibility. I have to be willing for that too. I can't be willing only for the success of a retreat house. I have to be willing to follow my guidance without attachment and let this work out in whatever way it's going to be. And again, the funny thing is we found that was on, I think, a Tuesday. We found the retreat house on Friday. So I really was up to here with the water. But I didn't know I was going to find a retreat house in 3 days. I had no idea. You just got to be happy with whatever is. No satisfaction and you shall not be imperiled. Then you will long endure. And I don't think this means physically. I think this means you will awaken to that which has no end. Knowing contentment avoids disgrace. Knowing when to stop avoids danger. Knowing when to stop is very different than knowing satisfaction. But I'll just say knowing when to stop just again means having that integrity. You know, what if I had been guided to say, stop, we're not going to get a retreat house. I was wrong. Here's your money back. Well, then I got to do that. I can't be attached to getting the retreat house, right? Thus one can endure indefinitely. That's it. I'm not going to start another one because we only have 60 seconds. So I know when to stop. Releasing the light.